7654321.
You'll never have the sacred stone.
Oh, this you crazy mother.
Hey, League of Wildness, Wildman Dan here, and welcome to the Live Wild or Die podcast. On this episode, I want to dive into my notes and my highlights from a book called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. It's by an author, Oliver Berkman. And before we dive in, I got to give a shout out to Earl Wildman of the North. He recommended this book to me. I essentially read the entire book on a flight to Vietnam a few weeks back, and I just can't get it out of my head. I reread it actually once I got back home, and it's really like a slap in the face just of how I've been living, and I'm sure how a lot of others are living as well. But I'm just kind of working on digesting a lot of the thoughts, the concepts, the reactions I'm having to it. So I'm kind of using this as a little bit, using this podcast a little bit selfishly as sort of a cathartic experience for myself to just kind of work through the thoughts, concepts, philosophies, and see how I myself may apply them, and then maybe there are some things you guys can use for yourself. So basically what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go through my highlights. I'll read the highlight, and then I've got a few notes, comments I'll make to that as well. So we'll see where this goes. It'll certainly be a journey. So let's dive in. All right, so I'm basically just going through in sequential order of the book. So you're going to kind of get this highlight summary of at least what I highlighted. So starting, first highlight is, instead of simply living our lives as they unfold in time, instead of just being time, you might say, it becomes difficult not to value each moment primarily according to its usefulness for some future goal or some future oasis of relaxation you hope to reach once your tasks are finally out of the way. That's totally me. It's so me. And it's kind of been this, it's like a disease that's been festering kind of since this whole entrepreneurial journey was started, at least with Wild Gym specifically. So that would have been February of 2013. But my kind of reaction to it was, in where I'm at now, and I'm sure where a lot of us are, where if you have a desk job, computer job, very much what you're doing is future-based in the sense of you don't get to see the results of the task you're working on immediately. Maybe, you know, you're creating a piece of content, you're working on a project, whatever it is, it very much tends to be future-focused. So there's this gap, there's this disconnect between the action you're taking and the actual result of that action. Whereas you think of, this quote made me think of basically like a hunter-gatherer. A hunter-gatherer, they hunt when they're hungry and they gather when they're hungry. They don't necessarily ruminate about hunting or worry about hunting. They simply do it when they need to. And I didn't highlight this, but the book talks about how essentially the invention of time just totally changed that itself, the invention of time, or at least not the invention of time, but the invention of the clock, which allowed us to measure time and essentially commoditize time, totally changed just how we as humans approach time. And it certainly has led to some positive benefits. Part of the main reason for that, why it was so valuable, was being able to measure time, quantify time, and agree on it essentially on like a worldwide basis allowed people to cooperate. If you think about like in factories, things like that in the Industrial Revolution, and that kind of helped systemize all that and bring everything together. Okay, moving on to my next highlight. And this is leading in from a previous thought, but it was essentially referring to this action makes it impossible to experience deep time, that sense of timeless time, which depends on forgetting the abstract yardstick and plunging back into the vividness of reality instead. For me, my experience of that type of feeling has come primarily from sports and time in the outdoors. So when I was an athlete, I played lacrosse in college and hockey as well, but lacrosse was definitely the most intense in college. And I remember, like, you'd go out on the field, you're so focused on just being in that exact moment. Your mind can't wander. For one, it's dangerous, right? It's a contact sport. So if you kind of start daydreaming, looking off into the void, I mean, you could get seriously injured. But being in that environment, it forced you to be present. And then kind of in my post-college life, it's been the outdoors. And specifically, I think climbing and hunting really bring about that deep time where I'm not even, I guess, experiencing time in the way that we normally do, where you're kind of seeing the clock, seeing the seconds tick by. It's almost becoming time in a sense. And there's a highlight for that in a little bit, but I've noticed for climbing specifically, especially when it gets a little bit harder and potentially even a little bit more dangerous, you're so focused on that present moment because one, your life depends on it. You're so focused on that moment that your mind just doesn't really have the option to wander. And then same thing with hunting. It's maybe a little less intense with the danger aspect, although that certainly does exist. Especially, at least it feels like it does at night when you're walking out and all of a sudden, you know, you see eyes in front of you and your headlamp or, something pops out or there's a weird shadow. I mean, it's, that certainly exists. But hunting for me has brought about, it's like this, how would I describe it? I guess the word mindfulness comes to mind, but it's essentially just living very much in the present moment and being very much aware of every small detail of your surrounding and not necessarily projecting out, using it, you're using that to project out to the future, but it doesn't cause anxiety. So in the sense of, you know, you see a track, you see a broken twig, you're processing that mentally, but it doesn't elicit anxiety like thinking about, you know, paying bills or a due date or a deadline or things like that. So I really like that quote. Okay, next highlight. Time. Our culture's ideal is that you alone should control your schedule, doing whatever you prefer whenever you want, because it's scary to confront the truth that almost everything worth doing, from marriage and parenting to business or politics, depends on cooperating with others and therefore on exposing yourself to the emotional uncertainties of relationships. This one hit me hard, big time. And I can trace it back to, you know, quick hydration moment here. I can trace it back to essentially reading The 4-Hour Workweek. So that's The 4-Hour Workweek. It's by an author named Tim Ferriss. And it was all about kind of escaping the 9-to-5 and the grind and becoming this digital nomad and controlling every aspect of your life through creating a business and blah, 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 automation, all this stuff, productivity, things of that nature. When you're reading it, it sounds awesome. Like the theory behind it sounds awesome, but what the book and what this quote's trying to highlight is essentially you could have, and I've experienced actually this a ton myself. You know, I basically am working alone. I work at home, so I do spend time with my wife and kids throughout the day, but you know, I'm generally alone. I'm upstairs in like a little studio loft where I've got my setup, but I've very much experienced this myself where I have this very flexible schedule, but my friends all have more rigid schedules, so I end up just doing things alone oftentimes. And I also noticed this when I was a ranger. You know, I essentially lived out in the wilderness. I worked with partners, but I worked alone a lot as well. And I had a very flexible schedule. I had all this free time, but again, it's like I wasn't in sync with most of my friends. So therefore it didn't really provide me much benefit. But yeah, I've noticed this, like there's like this hesitancy, and I'm speaking for myself. There's this hesitancy to commit to things for the fear. It's FOMO, essentially. It's fear of missing out of these like potential opportunities that may arise instead of just, if you just committed to the thing and kind of could ignore those other opportunities, you'd probably be much more settled, much more happy. Next highlight, I really liked, so this, I believe, is a German word, but it's Eigenzeit, or the time inherent to a process itself. So basically what they were talking about in this part is with the clock and the measuring of time, the quantification of time, and the commodification of time. There we go. Basically, we're always trying to measure and quantify a task, whatever it is. This Eigenzeit is basically saying, it's a totally different approach. It's just let a task take the time it needs, and don't try and quantify it. Don't do anything like that. There's two things that came to mind when reading this quote. One is hunting is a great example. You can't, it's going to take the time it takes. You can't force it. It's you engaging with a wild animal and trying to pattern their patterns and understand what they're doing. There's weather events. There's so many external factors. You're essentially trying to put yourself in high odds situations, but you just trying to speed things up or doing anything close to that, it's only going to result in general in negative outcomes. And the other one was putting a toddler to bed. So I have two kids right now, 2 and 4 years old, 2 daughters. They're awesome. And it's like trying to put a toddler to bed faster than they want to go to bed. And this could be like trying to get a toddler dressed faster than they want to get dressed, anything like that. It just, by trying to speed up the process, you're only going to make it worse for the vast majority of the time. So it's being able to have the really just the patience with, which I know for myself, and maybe it's a learned trait to be impatient, which I'm really trying to work on. I'm certainly struggling, but identifying the problems to start, right? Okay, next highlight. There is an alternative, the unfashionable but powerful notion of letting time use you, approaching life not as an opportunity to implement your predetermined plans for success, but as a matter of responding to the needs of your place and your moment in history. This one, I'm still, I guess, kind of working through this one in a way, because you could interpret this book as kind of saying, you know, almost like there could be a way to interpret a lot of these things with almost apathy or an apathetic response of, well, whatever I do doesn't matter and blah, blah, blah. So why even bother? I don't think that's what the author's intent was at all. That's actually for sure. Their intent is not that at all. But it's essentially having a mindset, being okay with maybe not fully optimizing or fully maximizing the potential for time and letting things slow down a little bit. It's almost like, I was thinking about this before I started recording, but maybe going back to like a, you know, 1950s pace of life, something like that, or even like the 80s. I don't know. Like I watched Stranger Things and, you know, I was born in 1985. So I definitely have straddled both sides of the fence of, you know, landlines, essentially the pre-internet world. And it was great. You know, we did just fine. I don't know, but that's, I'm still kind of digesting that highlight a little bit. So let's move on. Next, there's no reason to believe you'll ever feel on top of things or make time for everything that matters simply by getting more done. So I had a conversation with Earl, Wild Man of the North, when he first introduced this book to me. And this was essentially the first thing he told me. It was basically by being more productive and optimizing more things, you essentially just make time for more things and more work. So by being more productive, you end up creating more work for yourself, if that makes sense. And this kind of segues nicely into the next highlight, which is work expands so as to fill the time available for its completion. So this made me think back to the classic all-nighter in college, writing whatever paper it was. You had all semester to do it, but for some reason you could get the whole thing done in like, 8 hours of stressful pounding of keys. Was it the best result? Definitely not. But I think the point is, well, let me take a step back. I'll share another anecdote. So there's a classic all-nighter. I certainly experienced that. I'm sure many of you have as well. Is it the best result? Maybe, maybe not. I'm going to say likely the best result would not be from doing the all-nighter. You could get the work done, but was it the optimal way or was it the most pleasant way? Hell no. I remember, I don't know why I was able to do this, but it was my senior year of college. It might have even been the last semester. I can't remember specifically. I think it was actually. So it was my final semester of my senior year of college. I had this, it wasn't like your college thesis, but it was a big paper for the program I was in, which was human science. And I was doing kind of like a environmental toxin paper. And I don't know why I was able to do this specifically for that paper, but I essentially would work on it, maybe 10 minutes a day, an hour a day. I started working on it immediately, worked on it just a little bit the whole semester. And it gave me the time to, maybe I'm reading a research paper. I could get into that kind of deep time or that flow state reading it and not feel rushed and worrying about the time and worrying about getting it done. I was able to just be more present while I was going through it. And I think it was for sure one of the best things I produced during my time. And I don't know why that is challenging, right? Again, it's the time, the work expands so as to fill the time available for its completion. You can do the all night, you can have all semester to do something and you end up writing the whole paper in one night. Conversely, you can do 10 minutes of work for 6 months every single day, and typically the result is going to be much better. But there's something about those 10 minutes, which I feel like there's more resistance to. I don't have the answer to it, but I guess I'm just simply identifying the phenomenon of that. Okay. Next is, this is in reference to, I believe it was a woman. I can't remember what she did specifically, but it was kind of a, high power, very demanding kind of corporate type of job. But the passage I highlighted is, she moved with her husband and children to a farm in the vast swath of the Canadian interior known as the Land Between, where each winter day begins by lighting the fire that will warm the farmhouse and provide heat for cooking. And I remember this passage now. So someone asked her, how long does it take you in the morning before you have your first cup of tea or first cup of coffee? And she kind of went through her morning routine, which is much different than kind of the get yourself hyped for the day morning routine that's going around the socials right now. And, she would talk about doing her chores, taking care of the animals, things like that nature. And it was maybe 45 minutes to an hour before she kind of could take a moment, have tea, coffee, whatever it is. But what this highlight makes me think about is, how do you rectify the simple life that's being described here with the most beneficial aspects of modernity? And for me, the number one thing that comes to mind is medicine. Modern medicine keeps a lot of people from dying. And I would say it's mainly like trauma care, right? So you think about, you break your leg, you go to the ER, it gets fixed. Maybe you need surgery, stitches, whatever, antibiotics. Huge, like, these wars that occurred in the early half of the, especially early on in the 20th century, early 1900s, like most people died from things like the flu or infections. And same thing pre to that, like Civil War. I mean, it was disease that killed the most amount of people. not that they weren't horrible wars aside, but anyhow, on top, back on topic, modern menace is something I definitely wouldn't want to take away. And I also wrote my notes here. I have communication question mark. This kind of goes back to the more productive you can be, or the more you can optimize things, the more you have time to do more work. Does the speed of communication, is that a net benefit? Probably. There's probably a net benefit of being able to call essentially anyone, anywhere on the entire planet. That seems beneficial, but it's the culture, mindset, and approach to that. You know, we, in 2017, my wife and I spent like 3 weeks in Italy, and again, we're on vacation, so it's hard to compare apples to apples, but we didn't really, did I have a smartphone at that time? Yeah, I think I had my first iPhone at that time, but we didn't have cell service in Italy. We had Wi-Fi, so we could use Wi-Fi at the Airbnbs or wherever we happened to be staying. We could use the Airbnb, the Wi-Fi. But we didn't have like 24/7 high-speed connections. And I think most of the Italians around us did, but there was just something about the pace of life that, like, man, it was so refreshing. And what I found interesting is I did find myself getting slightly annoyed at times. And this maybe wasn't so much in Italy, but this was in Spain in 2010. I did a trip with a couple college friends and did kind of the classic backpack Euro trip. But we were like backpacking in the wild. We did, I think it was 2 weeks. We were in the Pyrenees, and not to go too deep into that story, but it was, I didn't really understand that Spain was like what latitude it was at and how the weather worked there. So we were basically like winter camping, like getting dumped on with snow. It was a wild experience for sure. But yeah, it's just, again, how do you rectify the simple life with the most beneficial aspects of modernity? I don't know. Cause there's like, that's the other thing too, right? It's like you could buy the land or move to, you know, a more rural area, but then are you just alone on your kind of little homestead? Like, is that actually what is going to lead to the best life, the happiest life, the most joyful life? I don't know. I spent a lot of time alone in my kind of mid to late 20s, again, as a ranger, and don't think that was necessarily the best thing for my mental health. So it's like, how do you have that community, but maybe find that slow down pace of life? If you guys know, shoot me a note. We'll keep marinating on that though. Okay. I got to scroll through here just a little bit more. Where was I? Okay, here we go. Next highlight is we invariably prefer indecision over committing ourselves to a single path because the future, which we dispose of to our liking, appears to us at the same time under a multitude of forms equally attractive and equally possible. This makes me think just kind of, it's about the problem of choice, right? The more choices you have, in general, the more dissatisfied you tend to be with your particular choice, right? If you have 100 options, but you have to choose one, you have the FOMO, or you feel like you're missing out from the 99 others. And I think what this passage is referring to is we tend to not want to commit to something that's going to potentially relegate us from having other options in the future, which, you know, they might be awesome options, but there's something about just committing to a path that can be really, I think, can provide a lot of freedom, to be honest. So something to think about a little bit for yourself, and certainly I do as well. You know, as an entrepreneur running the business, like I heard this quote from a guy named Eric Bandholz. He has a brand called Beard Brand. So if there's any bearded listeners, check them out. I'm still working on mine, but he basically, I've heard him say this multiple times, but he basically said, as an entrepreneur, you see the opportunity in everything. So it's, you get this shiny object syndrome where you start chasing these shiny objects, seeing the opportunity in everything. When in reality, if you just focused on the one thing, if you could identify and then focus on the one thing that, one, you were best at, and two, provided the best, I guess, return, you'd be so much more successful in business specifically. And it's probably true with life in a way as well, as if you just focus on the one thing that gives you the most life satisfaction and could kind of ignore all the potentials you see, it might work out for the better. Okay, so this next passage is talking about this guy. I believe he was in Japan. He was trying to essentially join these monks in Japan, and they kind of gave him this initiation process, and part of it was pouring ice cold water over himself. And the passage goes, "The more intensely he could hold his attention on the experience of whatever he was doing, the clearer it became to him that the real problem had been not the activity itself, but his internal resistance to experiencing it. When he stopped trying to block out those sensations and attended to them instead, the discomfort would evaporate." So again, this passage is talking about a guy, he's pouring ice cold water over himself. The thought fallacy he was making previously was he's trying to think of anything but the ice cold water. And there was something about leaning into it, kind of leaning into the discomfort, leaning into the sensation, leaning into the present moment, even though it was incredibly uncomfortable, it paradoxically made the discomfort evaporate. So my note was, focusing on the uncomfortable thing made the discomfort go away. We've said this before on the podcast, but it's being comfortable, being uncomfortable, comfort in discomfort. Yeah, I wonder, again, that this makes me think back to that when I was talking about writing the college paper. It's uncomfortable. There's something uncomfortable about doing the thing that you should be doing. I don't know why. But if you could lean into that discomfort, do the 10 minutes a day, the outcome is going to, you're going to, one, feel better in the moment, and two, the outcome will also be much better. I really like this next one. "The most effective way to sap distraction of its power is to just stop expecting things to be otherwise. To accept that this unpleasantness is simply what it feels like for finite humans to commit ourselves to the kinds of demanding and valuable tasks that force us to confront our limited control over how our lives unfold." And again, my note was, comfortable being uncomfortable, don't try and fight it. And as I mentioned earlier, I do think there you could interpret some of the stuff in this book as kind of taking this apathetic approach to life. Well, nothing I do matters, and why am I, you know, pushing myself to try and achieve these things when in the end it's not going to matter and it's just making me miserable in the process? That's the intent in my response to it is not one of apathy. Instead, I think it's taking a more appropriate and realistic and healthy and natural and human approach to life and just, I guess, productivity, work, everything. Just I think it's not, I don't even want to, maybe it doesn't even make sense to separate those things. It's just life. You have to, this is the approach to take to your life. I had a thought and then it totally snuck away from me, so I paused for a second, but we're back. So what I was going to say is, I've heard Jordan Peterson talk about this, where it's, you should essentially take on the biggest challenge that's maybe just outside your comfort zone. And that's what you should do, things like that. You should live your life in this way, where you're doing these meaningful things, these things that give you purpose, and they should be challenging. And I agree with that. And that's, I think I've leaned into that, at least at moments throughout my own life. However, it can be taken to an extreme. I was communicating with actually one of the guys I did that trip to Spain with. Shout out to BK. But he's been a really successful mutual fund. I don't even know how I would describe his work, but he's working in mutual funds, essentially working with financial advisors and he's done really well for himself financially, and we'll send each other different social media posts and all that. And he sent me a few that were kind of like these, you know, you got to work hard and hustle and da, da, da. And there's the hustle culture, right? And there's something about it that's attractive, I think, to a lot of people, especially a lot of men. But my question is, like, where do you draw that line, right? How do you find something that's challenging and is purposeful and gives you meaning, but doesn't put you in that state of anxiety where you're constantly focused on the future and all that? And, you know, on social media, there's all this, like, you know, wake up at 4 a.m., do your morning hype routine, sleep for 4 hours and become a billionaire. Like, is that what we should celebrate? I mean, I don't know. It depends. I guess it depends on what you're doing. But for businesses, I guess their success is measured with dollars. Dollars typically reflect to the value that we place upon something. However, maybe our values need to be reanalyzed a little bit. So moving on. So this is the highlight. So a surprisingly effective antidote to anxiety can be to simply realize that this demand for reassurance from the future is one that will definitely never be satisfied. No matter how much you plan or fret or how much extra time you leave to get to the airport, you can't know that things will turn out all right. This I feel on a daily, hourly, potentially even like minute by minute basis at times. And it's, again, this is kind of being an entrepreneur or business owner, is essentially you always want to have the certainty that, you know, there's going to be money in the future and things are going to continue to be okay and all that. But there's just no way to guarantee that. Anything can happen. You know, we had the fire come through here about a year and a half ago. So a fire essentially burned down my entire town. Our house did not burn, but we were displaced for 5 months, and we moved like 20 times within that 5 month period. We lived in a hotel with this would have been a 1 and 3 year old and a dog. We were living in separate rooms at times. I mean, it was just trying to maintain the business. Basically, it was just the absolute minimum to try and not go out of business. So you just never know what's going to happen. And to want that certainty and that guarantee of everything, quote unquote, being okay in the future, just, it's not realistic. And it's kind of like, there's a process. This is actually a Tim Ferriss process. At least that's where I heard it. But there's a process called fear setting, where essentially it's very simple, but the fear setting process is essentially, it's identifying the potential, like the worst possible scenario of an outcome to whatever action you want to take. It's identifying what the worst thing is, some steps of how you might mitigate that. And the whole idea is to just kind of help assuage that anxiety of the future. So I totally get it. And it's kind of like acceptance of the uncertainty. Okay. This next one is, it's kind of a dot, dot, dot. We should aspire to confine our attentions to the only portion of time that really is any of our business, this one here in the present. When I hear about being present, mindfulness, all that stuff, I totally get it. And again, I mentioned there's those activities, climbing, hunting, being outside, where I certainly am able to experience that, playing sports. I'm in the present moment. My counter thought to that is, well, if you're always in the present, your present moment could degrade over time if you do not account for the future. So I think you got to read. What they're saying is, it just requires a little bit of reading between the lines, or maybe just thinking between the lines, is you can't totally sacrifice the future for the present, but you don't, maybe that's what it is. Maybe that's what it is. I just thought of this. We're always talking about sacrificing the present for the future. Or excuse me, you don't want to sacrifice your future for some present spontaneous action that may harm your future self, right? However, we don't often talk about harming our present self for the sake of our future self, which are always your present self. So if you're constantly harming your present self for your future self, you could essentially live a life of misery based on a quote unquote future that you will never attain because you're always actually in the present. Wild. That might be an original thought right there. Well, let me know what you guys think. Okay. This is a quote. I think this is a Bible quote. I think this is, they're quoting, I believe it was a Sermon on the Mount, and my biblical knowledge is limited, but I'll read the quote. So I believe this is Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. So take no thought for the morrow, for the morrow shall take thought for the things of itself. Sufficient to the day is the evil thereof. To be honest, I always have to read that a handful of times. I think, but in the actually the author and the you guys should just read the book, and when you see that passage, just let the author kind of digest that for you, because I don't want to butcher it, to be honest. This next one, the quote is, "You see, I don't mind what happens." And essentially, it's this guy giving a talk, and he kind of does this really strange thing in the middle of the talk, and everyone's kind of looking around the room like, what is this dude's deal? And then he says, "You see, I don't mind what happens." His point being was he wasn't affected by the future, essentially. And this kind of segues into the next highlight is, it's an expression of your current thoughts about how you'd ideally like to deploy your modest influence over the future. The future, of course, is under no obligation to comply. Basically, in this kind of part of the book, it's talking about how you can do all this work, think you have the future totally dialed in, you've planned for retirement, blah, 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 but then it's 2008 and the entire stock market crashes and you're totally screwed. Things like that. So it's kind of accepting that the future will never be certain. And it's not saying don't plan for it, but my interpretation is don't expect your plans to necessarily work out. And if they don't, you need to kind of, as a previous quote was, you need to not mind what happens. Okay. This quote I really liked. By trying too hard to make the most of his time, he misses his life. By trying too hard to make the most of his time, he misses his life. I've had this conversation several times in the past, and even before I read this book, but it's kind of like if you think about productivity and time optimization is all these things, is there would be this inflection point where you essentially spend so much time optimizing and trying to be productive that essentially becomes the end in itself. Your whole life becomes around optimization and productivity, so you never actually get to take advantage of the optimization and productivity and efficiency that you created. And again, that's what Earl's point when we had the first conversation was basically, if you're more productive and efficient and make more time for yourself, you tend to fill that time with just more work, more productivity, and more being efficient. So it's kind of having the discipline in a way to, when that time does open up, to not use it, which is kind of a strange thing to say. Okay, next highlight is, living more fully in the present may be simply a matter of finally realizing that you never had any other option but to be here now. I like this a lot because, again, I'm so guilty of this myself, of kind of like living in this future idyllic possibility that you can kind of create this reality in your mind, right? Because in theory, the future is totally open to infinite possibility. But the reality is that your only real option is to be in the present moment. It's a little bit heady, but I think you guys get what I'm trying to say. Okay. Let's see here. Oh yeah, this is a good one. So I don't really need to read this whole quote, but essentially the last line is, it's the most consequential of superpowers, patience. The most consequential of superpowers is patience. I'm a super impatient person, and there's two things I can kind of remember, or traits that I noticed, that I notice now as an adult that I had very early on as a kid, and definitely impatience was one, which I guess, I wouldn't say I'm globally impatient. Like I think, in the sense of delayed gratification, I think I'm actually pretty good at that, right? So I'm willing to put in the work or withhold instant gratification to see a future result. And I would say like fitness, health, exercise, nutrition, that's something certainly that I've been very disciplined at and I think I have a aptitude for. Patience for things like business and work that's not necessarily physical in nature, I think I kind of suck at that. Like I noticed my mom used to call me out on this, but like I can remember in elementary school, it was always like I rush my work. I noticed and I talked about that one paper in college where I took basically the whole semester to just kind of chip away at it. I've noticed that if I can do the work in that compressed amount of time, and it's a decent result, but if I could slow down and kind of marinate in the process more, I would get less done absolutely, but the quality would increase. So it's kind of like a quality versus quantity approach. And I think that just goes back to feeling like I don't have enough time to take the time to dive deep and really have those deep thought processes. It's always kind of like it's production. It's being productive. More equals better, right? Versus quality. So that's something I certainly noticed myself, and maybe you guys can relate to that as well. This next quote, the quote is, that's because you don't take the time. And this really segues in. And my note is, we think we don't have time. But basically, that's because you don't have time was, it's a guy walking by his neighbor, kind of tinkering on a car. And this guy kind of makes an offhanded comment about how I don't have time, or I could never do that, or I don't know how to do that. And the neighbor says, well, that's just because you don't take the time. And kind of takes this guy back, and he ends up, there was a car that broke down, so he didn't really know what he was doing, but he said, okay, I'm going to take the time. So he gets under, gets comfortable, just slows everything down. Slow is smooth, smooth is fast. Slows everything down, and he can kind of like, by staring at the mechanics underneath the car, at first it's just totally abstract, totally, he has no comprehension of really what's going on, but as he looks at it and kind of can get into that deep thought space and see each little piece and how they connect, he's able to identify the problem. And as a non-mechanic, he fixes his car by just taking the time. I always think about, and actually in surveys we've put out, not being too busy, quote unquote, or not having the time has been what at least a lot of League of Wildness members have said is an obstacle to their health and wellness. But maybe that's all just that's just perception, you know? Maybe you do have the time, but you don't take the time. You have the time, but you don't take the time. And I suspect that's true for a lot of people that might be struggling to, quote unquote, find the time to work out. You probably have the time, but you're just not taking the time. So think about that. Okay. Next is life just is a process of engaging with problem after problem, giving each one the time it requires, that the presence of problems in your life, in other words, isn't an impediment to a meaningful existence, but the very substance of one. Okay, so I love this because as humans, we're basically super problem solvers. I mean, that's problem solving is super fun in the right environment with the right mindset. And think about it. If you, and I've experienced this myself, maybe you guys have, but there's been a few vacations, like my honeymoon, for example. We went to Mexico. We did the classic. It was awesome, except we got sick, which was a bummer. Montezuma got us. But, you know, it's like the classic. You're in Mexico. You're on the beach drinking margaritas. It was great for like an afternoon. And then you get restless. You want to go snorkel. You want to go work out. Like that whole idea of retiring into the sunset, sipping margaritas on the beach, it's just, it's such a fallacy. And I've seen, it's not been hundreds, but I've certainly seen a lot of people that they retire, they sit on the couch, they watch TV, and then they essentially just die. It's crazy to watch and see. And then the other side of that is folks that stay engaged. Like my parents are actually really good examples. They're both retired, but it's like they're almost busier than they were when they were working because they're doing all kinds of stuff in the community and constantly going out with friends and to concerts and events. It's really inspiring and encouraging to see. You know, they're certainly not slowing down. And that engagement in that community and that social circle is so important. But going back to this quote, so again, it's, I really like the last one. So the presence of problems in your life, in other words, isn't an impediment to a meaningful existence, but the very substance of one. So it's essentially like seeing problems as, it's the solving of problems that creates meaning. And the expectation that once you solve one problem that you'll never have to solve any more problems is completely erroneous. So it's kind of like, it's learning to enjoy that ride of, okay, we're going to dive in, we're going to focus, we're going to solve this problem. And if you can, I think, approach that without the anxiety of time and productivity, it's going to be such a more pleasant process. Okay. And this quote's a little, well, I'll just share it. So the quote is, originality lies on the far side of unoriginality. And the story they tell in the book is essentially these bus routes and how there's all these different buses going all these different places, but the first like 2 miles of every bus's journey is the same. So they all go from the bus station, they all drive the first same 2 miles, and then there's a junction and they all go all vary which ways. And so the point the book was trying to make is we want to be original very early on in the journey, when in fact the best thing to do is learn from others and then make it your own. So learn from this really well-worn path. Learn from the things that have worked really well, get your reps. And then once you've done that, you can start to junction off and get more into the realm of originality. Little slightly off, not off topic, but slightly different from what we've been talking about, but useful nonetheless. Okay. We're going to get, there's a decent amount. We're moving through it. Thanks for hanging with me here. So we're getting towards the latter half here. So this quote, we're going to start to get a little deep. This quote is, which is why it's useful to begin this last stage of our journey with a blunt but unexpectedly liberating truth, that what you do with your life doesn't matter all that much. And when it comes to how you're using your finite time, the universe absolutely could not care less. This is one of those quotes again that it could elicit a sense of apathy, but to me it's very freeing. It's like, oh wow, like the universe doesn't care. Most people don't care what I'm doing on my day-to-day basis at all, assuming I'm not directly harming them. But the point being, like, thinking, how would I say this? Assigning too much you can assign too much meaning to something in a way and make it too serious and ultimately cause too much stress, too much anxiety to make the thing as meaningful as it could be if you were to approach it more with this attitude. And I think maybe let me read the next highlight and then I'll start to riff on it a little bit more. So this is a longer one. It's the feeling of realizing that you'd been holding yourself and all this time, holding yourself all this time to standards you couldn't reasonably be expected to meet. And this realization isn't merely calming, but liberating, because once you're no longer burdened by such an unrealistic definition of a life well spent, you're free to consider the possibility that a far wider variety of things might qualify as meaningful ways to use your finite time. You're freed too to consider the possibility that many of the things you're already doing with it are more meaningful than you'd supposed, and that until now you'd subconsciously been devaluing them on the grounds they weren't significant enough. This passage reminds me of when I was a firefighter. It was my first big fire, and it was my first season firefighting, and we went to California for this huge fire. It's like hundreds of thousands of acres, but there was a kid on the crew, and I remember he was having a conversation with someone else, and he basically said, you know, my goal in life is to just be a good dad. And I think even hearing me say just be, let me say that again. His goal in life was to be a good dad, not just be a good dad. And, you know, my wife and I have talked about this a little bit, and I've thought about it myself, but essentially it's like we're brought up in this environment where you're supposed to have these like huge goals and have this huge success and achieve all these amazing things, when couldn't we also consider it to be a huge success and amazing, and like you're spending your time well, like being a good parent, having good relationship with your kids, spending time with friends, like couldn't we approach things like that with the same reverie that we do these other things? So yeah, I think it's just significant, meaningful, all that. It's a very, very subjective concept, but it's being able to accept what maybe Instagram doesn't celebrate the thoughtful parent or the good friend more than they do, like, you know, the Lamborghini and six pack abs. Something to consider. Okay, getting near the end here. So this highlight is just, we are time. One more time. We are time. I thought this was in the title of this chapter is The Human Disease. I don't know if they're referring to the fact that we are time or maybe the thought that we are time as the human disease, but it's interesting to think about that way. As humans, we do essentially, we create a version of time that's maybe different from what is an experience in nature. And the book does talk about kind of like the mindset and life of people essentially before the clock, how of course time existed, but the relationship to it was quite different. Let me go to the next highlight here. It's entering space and time completely or even partially, which may be as far as any of us ever get, means admitting defeat. It means letting your illusions die. You have to accept that there will always be too much to do, that you can't avoid tough choices or make the world run at your preferred speed, that no experience, least of all close relationships with other human beings, can ever be guaranteed in advance to turn out painlessly and well, and that from a cosmic viewpoint, when it's all over, it won't have counted for very much anyway. I've always thought there's something I thought calming about, it's essentially zooming out. So if you start on Earth and then you zoom out into space, like, keep going out and out and out, it's like seeing how small the planet is and then how we are on the planet. There's something about that that just I find very comforting, in the sense of, you know, if you think about your day-to-day problems in life and this idea of hitting rock bottom, whatever that may be for us individually, it's like, even if that happens, if you can pull out that far and kind of zoom out, I think it makes it a lot easier to just kind of shrug your shoulders and keep putting one foot in front of the other. And again, what I want to really emphasize with this podcast is, to me, this book has really given me more of a sense of freedom and calming, and it's very much so an anti-anxiety read versus, again, there could be an interpretation that has more of like a apathetic approach, but again, that was not my experience, and that's certainly not what I'm trying to communicate with you guys. Okay, a few more here. Next highlight is, it's only unbearable for as long as you're under the impression that there might be a cure. Accept the inevitability of the affliction and freedom ensues. You can get on with living at last. And again, this kind of goes in the previous highlight in the sense of once you kind of accept it and stop battling it, then you become free. Okay, next one is, what would you do differently with your time today if you knew in your bones that salvation was never coming, that your standards had been unreachable all along, and that you'll therefore never manage to make time for all you hoped you might? So this passage makes me think of, there's a movie called Children of Men. It's a pretty intense movie, but the premise of the movie is people aren't able to have babies, basically. So there aren't any new babies. There's no new people. Essentially, like, the whole world has become sterile, and it's kind of turning into anarchy, and there's wars and all this stuff. And there's a scene in the movie where there's like this firefight and all these different people are shooting each other, and it's crazy, wartime, all this stuff. And essentially, this one girl is pregnant, and is kind of like, it's almost kind of this religious undertone to it, but this girl is pregnant and she has the baby, and they're walking out with the baby, and everyone, all these soldiers, people fighting, shooting each other, they stop for a second. It's just like jaw drops. It's a miracle. And then something happens where someone pulls the trigger, something happens, and they all go right back to fighting. But for what that highlight makes me think of is, it's that moment of stopping and kind of realizing, like, what the hell are we doing? And that's what, honestly, reading this book, 4,000 Weeks, it was a slap in the face for me of, like, it's like you feel like you're in this tense game. You're in this intense game, this battle. And then all of a sudden it's like you can kind of become an observer and see a little bit of the absurdity of it all. And I feel like I'm very much in like a reframing process. So I hope you guys do read it, and I hope it has a positive effect for you. Okay. Next is, where am I? Okay. Oops. Okay, here we go. To ask how we'd enjoy spending our time, but at the very least, you shouldn't rule out the possibility that the answer to that question is an indication of how you might use your time best. So one more time. To ask how we'd enjoy spending our time, but at the very least, you shouldn't rule out the possibility that the answer to that question is an indication of how you might use your time best. I think in the U.S. especially, we grew up with this cultural conversation and mindset, essentially, that you can do anything, right? Yeah, you can become whatever you want to become. And I believe that to a degree. And it's also, there's that enjoyment aspect to it. So it's like, if you're willing to live simply, live humbly, you can probably find something to do for a source of income, right? Because what I don't like is this, like, I don't like the idea of not participating in society in the sense of, like, you know, I was attracted to this idea of being kind of like a climbing bum in my early 20s, where, you know, you spend as little money as possible, you climb as much as you can, and you're kind of like not really involved with society, and nor do you necessarily contribute to it. And I always struggle a little bit with that, because it's like, felt like you were kind of mooching off everyone else in a way of you're kind of, yes, you're living a simple life, but you're also not contributing. However, I would say if you are willing to live more simply, like you probably can do something career-wise, if you want to use the word career. Let's just say maybe work's better. For your work, or at least maybe you work less. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's less about what you're doing for work and just how you're spending the majority of time. So maybe you could still have a job that you don't particularly like, but you only have to do that, you know, a handful of hours a day. So the vast majority of your time is open to do what you do truly enjoy. So there's a lot of ways to think about that, but, and I don't think it's necessarily like hedonistic with the right mindset and approach. It's enjoyment, but also creating purpose for yourself, meaning for yourself, which likely will spread out through the rest of society and culture. Okay. This next quote, I think we're almost, oh yeah. Okay. Second to last one here. The quote is, quietly do the next and most necessary thing. So I believe this is kind of like the end of the book where they're giving these kind of tactical pieces of advice. Well, it's definitely near the end of the book, but again, it's quietly do the next and most necessary thing. So I really like this. For me, I found this useful in the sense of operating a business, running a business, how to kind of go about my day, because it's so easy to be like, oh my gosh, email, got to respond to this, got to do this. But there's like, what is it? There's a whole like way to grid out things. There's the urgent, important, urgent, not important, all these different kind of tasks or ways you can qualify tasks. But quietly do the next and most necessary thing. I like that in the sense of if you can define, and that's where I think like staying really focused helps with that, right? If you're focused, you have a very kind of narrow path you're treading. You can quiet, it makes it a lot easier to identify and then quietly do the next and most necessary thing. Okay. Final highlight here. So in the life you will see incrementally taking shape in the rearview mirror will be one that meets the only definitive measure of what it means to have used your weeks well. Not how many people you helped or how much you got done, but that working within the limits of your moment in history and your finite time and talents, you actually got around to doing. It made life more luminous for the rest of us by doing whatever magnificent task or weird little thing it was that you came here for. I love that quote. And again, what it's kind of summarizing here is like, if you can accept and identify that we all have finite time, you're never going to even come close to doing all the things that you want to do, think you should do, quote, have to do. If you can accept that, then you can kind of lean into those few things and really give them your full, deep, present attention and probably make a better life for yourself and the rest of us. So that was, man, thanks for going on that journey with me. These thoughts, it's so useful for me to get these thoughts out loud, and I'm sure I'll do a few more on podcasts in relation to this book, and I'm sure I'll reflect back to it regularly, but there's something about putting ideas in my head out into the real world and just seeing how they float around and how valid they are. It's so useful. So thanks for going on the journey with me, guys. I'd love to hear your feedback. And again, I'd highly encourage you to read the book. Let me pull it up here just to be accurate. So again, the title is 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. It's by Oliver Berkman. Awesome, awesome book. Very easy to read. And honestly, a fun read. So, on that note, stoked to hear from you guys. Stay wild. Much love. I'll see you out there.